This episode is brought to you by Harrah's Resort SoCal. Nestled against a rolling hillside and just down the road from Palomar Mountain, guests at Harrah's Resort SoCal can expect gorgeous views, friendly staff, available night and day to encourage everyone to have a great time. When I was there recently, I had a chance to dine at California's first and the nation's largest Hell's Kitchen. And it's true, the beef Wellington and sticky toffee dessert are great. The restaurant is inspired by the hit TV show and features a menu approved by the Michelin star celebrity chef, Gordon Ramsay himself. Hope to see you all at Harrah's Resort SoCal in 2024.
I'm Duang Huang, and I'm a documentary filmmaker and oral historian from Vietnam.
Welcome to The Vietnamese. I'm your host, Kenneth Nguyen. Being part of a culture of nearly 100 million Vietnamese people in the world today comes with a lot of pain, proud history, and privilege. Join me as I highlight and explore the Vietnamese experience from all over the world.
What does it mean to be Vietnamese to you nowadays?
To be Vietnamese, I mean, there's the country of Vietnam, which has 98 million people. And those people are, you know, pretty solidly Vietnamese. And then there's a Vietnamese diaspora, which all over the world, and also have like their distinct cultures, like Vietnamese Americans who are from Virginia are a bit different from Vietnamese Americans from, you know, Westminster, California, with the largest Vietnamese population. So I've met Vietnamese Australians and thought, wow, you guys are so chill, like so not like my family. Yeah. And then I lived in London for a while, and the Vietnamese English are very English, you know, and wow, they speak with English accents and they're kind of cold and, you know, so, you know, to be Vietnamese for me is, it was almost like a secret. Like when I came to America, we were placed in Kentucky. So there weren't hardly any other Vietnamese people there that we knew. I think there was maybe consistently one other family that I knew the whole time when we lived in Kentucky. And so, you know, I remember kids asking me in kindergarten, like, are you black or are you white? When they started to notice at the end of the year, like before, you know, in pre-kindergarten and then kindergarten, they hadn't noticed. And then at the end of the year, suddenly the question came up. Mm. And the kids were musing, well, she has black hair, but she has like white skin. And this one other black kid said, she's white. and I knew what I was. I knew that I was from Vietnam, but I didn't want to tell them. I didn't want to, you know, make them think that I was different. And then of course, the older I got, the less I could hide that or brush that under the rug, you know, because it was going to be brought to the forefront to me, like, you're not from here, right? You know? So that was basically the, you know, like what I grew up hearing, where are you from? You're not from here, you know? And so I was always longing for this place that I belonged, this Vietnamese identity. So I just dreamed of going back to Vietnam. I thought, I have a grandma there, I have a grandfather there. Like, I'd be like these kids, I'd be normal if I had all that, you know? And when I went back to Vietnam, I was like, whoa, I'm not one of them. Like, what happened? Like, you know, I was like, this is a very sexist country, you know? Like,
how old were you when you first went back?
I was, like 25 or 26, you know? And so, 23. I was 23 when I went back for the first time. And my mom changed my year of birth, so it's really confusing. So my official year of birth is not actually my year of birth. Because she didn't like my sign.
Like, that's going to change the astrological movement of your life, right? The trajectory. Yes.
Yeah. I thought that was pretty funny, but it in fact probably helped because I was a little older than the kids, you know, in my class, even though I had a May birthday, but I was like just slightly older, you know, which gave me a little bit of an advantage. So I think it made me, you know, top of my class all the time and faster than other kids, which, you know, was really a gift.
Yeah. When you're that young and you have an extra year, you really get a lot of mileage out of that.
Yeah, because I would have been on the late end, you know, the youngest of the class. And that probably would have been hard. But yeah, just had a little bit more advantage.
Yeah. So there's like research on that stuff too. If, you know, now they push the kids, they hold them back a year to do that very thing.
So my mom just did it out of, you know, not liking Year of the Rat.
So you're like, the
bulls are luckier. I'm like, okay, she's a good sign for women. I'm like, yeah, and you just turned me into that.
Yeah. So you're the director of a movie called Oh Saigon. And what year was that released?
It was released in, I guess came out in, for film festivals and in theater and like in 2007, but it came out on PBS in 2008. And then, you know, Netflix in 2012, Amazon, Hulu, 2012 to 2016 or so, 18. And then, you know, now it's on YouTube. Yeah, but I started filming it in, I mean, it started off as an oral history project, you know, that I did in college, because I kept seeing Vietnam War movies that had no resemblance.
Right.
To anything my parents experienced. I remember being really attracted to MASH, just seeing Asian people like on television at all. Like, you know, in the 70s in America, the 80s, like there were very little representation at all. And when there was, you know, it was Long Duk Dong and 16 Candles, or, you know, they were not like the Mickey Rooney and Breakfast at Tiffany's. They weren't positive role models or even real, you know. And so I think I was always, I remember Fu Manchu, or, you know, like, yeah, like different people like that. And like, just searching for anybody to represent anything that I experienced or my parents experienced, and just coming up short. And people would tell me, you have to see this movie, you have to see The Deer Hunter, you have to see Hearts and Minds. And, you know, and I would see them and I would just want to cry, because like Vietnamese wasn't even spoken in a lot of those movies. And, you know, whenever things were portrayed, they were so, it was all prostitutes or people who like stab somebody in the back, or, you know, they were never positive. And it was painful, you know, to grow up with that. And coming back to Vietnam, like realizing like, oh, I'm another type of thing. We are the Phan Quoc, we are the traitors, you know, like we have another label here that we're the Viet Q, you know, Viet Q. And foreign Vietnamese. And it's like, I'd never heard that term before I came back in the 90s, you know, but I started filming. So I was trying to write a paper to kind of compare my parents and my experience to what was written in the media at the time, you know, magazines and newspapers, what was written in books, and what was shown in movies. And so I was taking oral history from relatives and family and, you know, putting that into papers to kind of, and I, you know, there were some books about refugees and the refugee experience written mostly by, you know, non-Vietnamese people. And I got a lot out of those. And I, there were points that, you know, my parents didn't remember that I could remind them of. I was like, how did you feel when they lowered the flag, the Vietnamese flag on the battleship? And, you know, like apparently that happened, you know, in the last hours of the existence of our, you know, country. And, you know, like my dad was so out of it. He didn't remember a thing
from
that week at all, you know. And my mom said she didn't sleep for 3 days and she was busy holding on to us to make sure we didn't fall off the battleship, because they didn't, it's not like they had rails. It wasn't a cruise ship, you know, it was for planes. And there are all these Vietnamese people sitting on it, and somebody yelled that their child had fallen into the ocean. And, you know, just the trauma of all, you know, it wasn't even over. It's like you get on this helicopter and there's all these people who don't make it, and then you get on the ship and there's more peril, you know, and then there's, you know, being a refugee for months and then being placed in this culture where they're like, what are you doing here, you know, who are you? And there were, you know, protests against desegregation when we arrived in Kentucky. The week we arrived, there were, you know, people were against going to, you know, school, like mixing, quote, races, you know? And so that was the type of culture we landed into.
You know, all of this stuff that happened, I was born after that. And I talk quite a bit about this on the podcast. It doesn't affect me the same way it affects somebody like you or your parents and my parents, right? Because you got to witness it firsthand and the traumas that happened. I was just talking to another guest yesterday in her 60s, and we were breaking all this stuff down, and the divide that happens between somebody in their 60s who's articulate in English, went through it when they were 15, going through what you just described, and where I am. And I just want, I'm always wanting the Vietnamese people. It's like parent, where, you know, you come from a divorced family and you just want the parents to love each other, and you want all your siblings to get reunited because we've all broken up. And are we ever going to get to that? And I think you do address that in the next project that you're doing, and we'll talk about that later. But because we're talking about that right now, I'm asking you, do you think that there's hope for us as a community in the world?
That's really an interesting point. And you put that really well, that, you know, it's kind of like this aspiration of belonging, you know, we're people who came out of a war. And that's, you know, I think of the people who are coming out of war now, like Ukrainian refugees, Syrian refugees. And it's like, you have this life and then suddenly you're branded a refugee and you're the unwanted, you know, and then you get put somewhere that you may not be wanted. And you're never really going to belong in that same way because you had to leave your country, you know?
You're never whole again.
Yeah. And it's like, I don't think war ever leaves people whole. And if you are a survivor of war, you have a few choices, right? Like, I am going to just be angry all the time and sad and take it out on everybody I love, you know, or, you know, be broken. I'm going to make that choice, right? Or you have the choice to like pretend it didn't happen and not talk about it and bury it. And then it comes out in weird ways. And then your children like have like, you know, the weird, they inherit it somehow, like without, you know, without you even, like my nephew doesn't know anything about the war. And my older sister is a survivor of many horrible things. He didn't know anything until he saw my film. And, you know, it's like, but he still is like hypervigilant and like codependent. Yeah. And, you know, it's still there, you know, he's always worried about something wrong happening. He was born fearful. So was my younger sister, who was born in America. You know, my mom was pregnant with her when we escaped from Vietnam. She was born fearful, you know? So there's like
in utero trauma. Epigenetic.
Yes. And we pass that on, and you see it, you know, yeah, in a lot of other cultures that have had trauma, like, you know, Native Americans, Jews, you know, like indigenous people all over the world, there's trauma that's happened, you know, African Americans, like the displacement of people. It's like, do you think America is healed from slavery? Like with right, all the stuff that's happened in the last
of years too. You're right. Yeah. You know, and I think I'm not looking for healing. I'm looking for like, is there any way where we can, you know, there's such a divide in the people that, you know, the previous generation has gone through it. And you know, I'm probably at the cusp of the border of the younger generation. I'm the oldest of the younger generation who never witnessed it.
Second generation, right?
I'm second, officially second generation.
I'm 1.5.
Yeah, you're 1.5. Yes. And yes, and yesterday I was talking to a 1.5 as well. And that conversation, there is no way that she's going to give up her position. And without that sort of give and take a little bit, like my job is, I feel like my job sometimes is to innovate and to figure out a way where we can talk through these points. And it gets exhausting to me to kind of mitigate this all, but I'm here. I want to dig through it and ask people like you, like what's next?
Yeah. I mean, that's your role too. And that's the lucky thing about being second generation, is that because you didn't experience that level of trauma, you know, you could actually do different things with it. You know, like my younger sister, she's the one who makes the most money out of my family. That's, you know, and it's like, it descend, like the oldest to the youngest, there's like, we increasingly make more money than the other. Like, what is that about? That's actually quantifiable. You know, those are numbers.
Right.
It's like, why are the oldest in my family unable to make money? You know, like what happened to them, you know, that it's like something, and these are people who are young during the war, you know, who, you know, my brother's case, he grew up here, and my older sister's case, she came at, you know, 20, 21. And, you know, like you think of trauma, and that's something that I really am noticing about the movie I'm making now, is that my brother and I had enough of an age difference where things affected us a bit differently.
Yes.
Because he's 4 years older than me. So I was three. I was a toddler.
Yeah.
You know, at the fall of Saigon. I like, there's things I remember and there's things I don't remember, you know, and my brother remembers everything. Like, he knew what was going on. He knew he was losing his home. He knew that this was terrifying. He knew that he was never going to see our neighbors again or our family again. Like, I can't imagine what that must have been like for him, you know, as a 7-year-old, you know, like he was almost seven. And it's like, can you imagine your own kids going through that?
No, it's brutal to think about it. And it's brutal to think about Ukraine and Russia right now, too, in that same vein.
Yeah.
I cannot, how can we be in this 2022 and still reading and watching this kind of stuff? It's horrific.
Yeah. I went to the Hiroshima Museum a few years back on my honeymoon. A great place to go for a honeymoon. Just and it was, we were, you know, we'd looked at the site of like the epicenter of the bombing, which was, you know, very scary, like an old building that was, you know, like one building was sort of saved, but damaged, and the whole rest of the city was flattened. And we were walking to the museum, and there was this sculpture of a child holding like a paper crane, but just the outline of it. And when you read the description, it says the artist was trying to show like the paper crane is like the life had never happened. It was just the outline of a life and these children died. And I just sat there and cried for 15 minutes before I even got to the museum. And then once we got to the museum, like, of course, you see horrifying melted things. And what got me is we got to this section where it was children's clothes that they were wearing when the bomb hit. And they had it on these tiny children. I just couldn't get through it. I was just like, we have to get out of here. I can't do it. You know, I was listening to like, you know, the museum recordings, and they were describing what these children went through and how some kid went into town to help people. Like, his parents sent him to go help some people, and they felt so bad because had they not sent him into town, he wouldn't have died. Yeah, but he came back, and then 3 days later, he just died, you know, and just countless children and these, and I think that's the hardest thing is like, these people who do this, do they not have children? Do they not think of children? Do they not think of innocent people? Do they not think of old people? Do they not love anyone? You know? And it's just like, certainly Putin doesn't want to die, you know? So it's like, why is this happening? You know? Like, you don't.
Yeah, I think if you are doing that kind of stuff, you've lost your soul a few decades before that, you know, to get to that Putin level or to any of these monsters, you know, Saddam level, you've lost your soul a few decades before that you're making these decisions.
I mean, I have to believe there's some humanity in there. I mean, I always have that hope that anyone can change, that anyone can see the light. Maybe I'm wrong, you know, but I have to believe that for myself.
Yeah.
You know?
You know, when you set out to make this film, O Saigon, how much of the story did you construct before you went to go shoot it?
Well, I actually didn't know all that much. I mean, I had some inkling, you know? So it's probably like when you start a podcast, you have some idea, but you don't know entirely, you know, what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. But that was kind of it. It's like,
that's good point.
Yeah, I set out, I wanted to like, I didn't know anything about filmmaking. I mean, I was, you know, I was writing a book. And so I was working at magazines in New York to try and fund writing a book. And that was my project, because that's what I knew. I wrote papers in college. And I did filming and stuff for fun. I went to like a middle school that taught television journalism. So I'd been filming on cameras since I was, you know, like 11 years old, and made my first documentary when I was 12 about war, you know? So it was already in me, but I kind of just saw it as a hobby. Like I didn't see it as anything that could be serious, you know? And then a friend of mine who she's known as Leti Yim Thuy, who is an author. She's a poet. And she wrote a book called The Gangster We're All Looking For. She was performing. She does these one woman shows that are incredible about the war and her family and her parents' love affair through the war. And she was doing a performance with a group called Club of Noodles, which was like a Vietnamese American comedy troupe. And I had never even heard of such a thing, you know? So I remember like going to Massachusetts and seeing all of these Vietnamese kids my age who were doing creative stuff. And my mind was blown, you know? I just couldn't believe that it existed because I just never had that much solidarity. You know, there was no VSA, like Vietnamese right. Student Association at the college. There is now, but, you know, there wasn't at the time. And, you know, growing up isolated from people, I didn't really know how to like, it's almost like I didn't know how to interact with people who were like me. Like it was right. So strange for me. And so, you know, I met Ham Tran, who is now a director of many, like a number of movies and narrative movies. And he's actually Filipino American, the Chris Seacat, who was in the troupe. And we talked about what I knew. You know, I knew that my family was on the last helicopter. I knew that I had family in Vietnam, and they were, you know, I was like, some part of me thinks that this might be a good film. And then they were like, yeah, you know, they were so encouraging. And Ham, you know, his aunt owned one of the early DV cameras, PD-100. So he's like, I can get the equipment. And so, you know, we just did it. We were like stupid kids. And we just got in a car with each other and drove across America and then flew to Vietnam and, you know, and worked tirelessly. We were trying to record as many stories as we could. And I think both of us were so voracious for the history that we didn't know, you know, about our own families, about, you know, about, you know, and we interviewed everybody we came in contact with.
So Ham shot this in the beginning? Wow. Yeah, and this was before Journey from the Fall?
Yes, it was before Journey, like by a couple of years and before the anniversary. Yeah.
So had he gotten into film school at UCLA, started that yet?
I think he had just finished film school and he was doing focus pulling on like Hollywood type stuff. So he really hadn't directed anything before or, you know, shot anything like that before. Like he barely knew how to use the camera. So, you know, like it was all new for both of us, you know.
You know, when I look at you, you remind me of like some young 30-year-old person, and now you're telling me like, oh, Ham worked on my film before Ham was Ham Tran, right?
Yes, yeah.
It's crazy. I'm like looking at you going, how is that possible?
And I think, you know, his movie The Anniversary was inspired by my uncle and my father. Mm. And then I've heard that other parts, like there's a character in his Journey from the Fall who cuts himself, I guess, in the hand that's inspired by one of my uncles, you know? Oh. So, you know, for him, it was an inspiring experience. And, for me, it was completely life-changing where, you know, like it was hard, honestly. It's like to hear, you know, somebody saying like, yeah, watch my husband shot down in the street, like on the last day of the war. Like, and, you know, these people are just living, they look like, you know, anybody else, yeah. You know, like, or somebody in a flowery hat or, you know, flowy pajamas or, you know, eating steak in their house in Texas. Like, you know, all of these people that you, on the outside, you don't know, you know, what it is like, you know, the people who work in my nail salon, like, you know, you don't know what they've been through or the dry cleaner or whatever. And I'm always aware of that after shooting this stuff, you know, where it's like, wow, everybody has got something.
Yeah. How did you get the archival footage? Because that was amazing.
Yeah, that was pretty. That was so I went to the National Archives of the United States and went through like all of their stuff and on Vietnam. And there was, you know, things that they had filmed in the 1950s. Of like in 35 millimeter, this beautiful footage of this colonial you know, colonized, you know, Saigon, like they're gorgeous. And those things shot in the 60s, handheld really badly, you know. So at first it was that, but then I hit a bunch of other archives, like the ABC archives and, you know, Video Source, like they had stuff from the BBC. Like I hit like as many archives as I could to just find what footage they had. And some of the stuff was from the Canadians, like archives and, you know, the British. I had some trouble with working with the Vietnamese, you know, it was not easy. I think they have a lot of control over media that comes out of there. So I think you have to sign something saying you're not going to do, like Ham said, he had to sign something saying I'm not going to do something political, you know, so it's really tricky with, and I wish there was more participation from Vietnam, but they have a very, they have, it's against the rules to say that the war was bad, you know? And you, there's no, there was no information on the boat people to the people in Vietnam. They had, they heard, they knew people, but they didn't know what it looked like. And so like when I showed O Saigon in Vietnam, it was interesting because like at the screening that was at the American consulate in Saigon, people were bawling. You know, they were just crying so hard. Like, I think they hadn't known exactly what their relatives had gone through. And they were just like the whole place was just, everyone was crying, you know? And then I showed it in the north and it was like crickets, you know? And then people were like kind of offended by some of the things my dad said. And been like, that's, you know, I remember actually somebody who worked for the U.S. State Department, who was Vietnamese and from Northern Vietnam, she was like, you're not allowed to say these things. I'm like, dude, we are at the U.S. Embassy. This is U.S. soil. And I know my rights.
You know? Holy shit. And what did she say?
I was like, I got my debriefing in D.C. Don't even tell me, you know. And so I kind of reported her to her. You know, and it's just like, don't you censor me, you know. You're working for the wrong country, you know?
And did it ever come, like, did she ever retaliate or did it ever come back to bite you in the ass?
I don't know what happened with it, but I, you know, I mentioned it to the people at the embassy and they are like, oh yeah, she's not allowed to say that to you. And I'm like, yeah, you talked to her.
Good for you for standing up. I mean, yeah, that's awesome.
My uncle, you know, he was a very idealistic communist. He was not the sort of communist who believed in imprisoning people or, you know, or he doesn't believe in the corruption that, you know, when you go to the airport, people are trying to shake you down, you know, when you come into Vietnam and you're Vietnamese American. He said to me, promise me you will never give in. You will never give in to corruption. Like, don't just let them hold you for hours and, you know, just don't sell out and make this place a bad place to live.
Wow.
And that really stuck with me.
You know, as I'm doing more of this work, I'm discovering that the camps were a big thing that turned people off in country.
Really?
Because it was like, okay, one thing to kick some ass and be like, yo, we won, right? It's one thing. And to take over and whoever speaks up, you lock them up. That's one thing, right? That's just part of the winning side. But I think there's some sentiment where people, just regular people, were just like, or academics too, just like, yo, that's fucked up. Like, that's not what we want for the country to be engaged in that kind of behavior where you just lock everybody up indefinitely and you quote unquote. So I think that people from all sides viewed that as a very touchy situation. And you can debate other things, but that one thing you cannot debate. Like, you can't just lock people up and quote unquote re-educate. And I think that's like something that's like a blemish in the history of that time. And that's where a lot of people find it hard to forgive. You know?
And I think we can learn from that in America because you can see that sort of mentality here, where we don't want to take the hands of the, you know, losers and we don't, you know, we're like, we're going to win at all costs and we're going to just annihilate you for losing, you know, like that's the sort of, it's kind of like, oh, if I'm in power, I'm going to take away all your rights. You know, like I think of Mitch McConnell from my home state, you know, it's like, I'm just going to like block you every chance of the way and not work with you and make this government not work. You know,
yeah, that's like human
shake hands with people across the aisle. I'm not going to, you know, work together. And it's like, I'm sorry, is this what we elected you for? To, you know, to just like not make anything happen, you know?
Yeah.
And for you to be in power, like that's, and I, you know, like I saw that a lot during these past couple of years where political division was just making people be like, you know, let's string them up, let's kill them, let's hang them, let's, you know, in both directions, in all directions, you know? Like there was such a strong hatred going on. And, you know, I could feel that. I remember feeling angry. But the thing is, it's like, this one thing to feel, but it's another thing to give into it.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's hard. That's a hard thing to keep in check as a human being, to keep an honest mind and say, you know what, I am going to do my best to like resist the urge to do what my emotions want me to do.
Yes. Yeah.
How did you get your family to agree to the narrative? Because it seems like when you watch O Saigon, if you set out to kind of depict what you already know that's going to show up, it would be hard in my book, in my imagination, to really sit your mom down and say, hey, mom, this is what I'm going to talk about in the movie. Are you cool with this? Or like, how did that all go down to get everybody to sign on?
There was a, you know, I'd never talked to my family like the way I talked to them when I interviewed them. It's like, if you can imagine what it's like to interview your own parents for your podcast or something, there's something that it's almost like the art of doing it, the format changes the relationship because they know that they're being filmed. They know that this isn't just for you. This is something that they can just say. You know, like it's, I remember my communist uncle, like staunchly communist, really critical of American culture. I had all of these DV tapes, you know, for the movie. And I remember him taking one out and said to his neighbor, this tape costs $15. It's 1 month's salary for me, 1 month's salary for my wife, you know? And I was like, oh no, he's going to go off on capitalism, you know, and go off on me or something. But he said, but to record our stories, she's using these to record our stories. And, you know, like it was this, I think there was something about the lens, the camera being there where it was like, they knew that it was more than just me, you know, like, I don't know if they knew or not, but my dad, you know, kind of avoided the interview. He was late, you know, he showed up like, we were supposed to film him in the afternoon. We had everything set up. Ham and I were just sitting there, you know, in the living room wondering, where's dad? And it was before people had cell phones as much, you know, it's in the 90s. And this was 99 when we filmed it, 90. Yeah, 99. And he got home at night. And so we had to relight everything. And he spoke, you know, for 4 45-minute tapes. And I just didn't think my dad was even capable of that. My dad barely talked, you know, while he was alive. And he was trying so desperately to protect us from the information. He somehow thought that if he told us what he had gone through, not just in that war, in the Vietnam War, but the previous wars. You know, my parents, I don't know about yours, but lived through three wars. It's like World War II, the war against the French for independence, and the Civil War of Vietnam involving the Americans, you know, and the Chinese and the Russians. And so that's a lot of trauma, you know, for someone to go through three wars. And you think about the culture, the Vietnam in general, you know, that strip of coast right there in the very southern and eastern part of Asia, what a sweet spot that is.
Yeah.
And how battle hardy you have to be to protect that, you know? So, you know, our people fought, you know, like fought the Chinese, fought the Mongols, you know, like, well, there's a legend about the Vietnamese being like one of the only countries to kick the Mongols out, you know?
Yeah.
And it's like, we have a proud history of war, of fighting other people off, you know? And that has, you know, and I think that there's an intensity in Vietnamese people that I really notice. Like, people are quick to like react, you know, like there's, you know, high belief in corporal punishment, for example.
Yeah.
Like in Vietnam, you hear people hitting their kids a lot. And, you know, there's a real Confucian kind of hierarchy. And, you know, you have a very specific place in your culture. You're numbered, you know, in your family. You're called by your number, you know, and if you're a woman, you have a very specific role in your family, especially if you're the oldest girl, like all of these things that you're the oldest brother, you have a very prescribed, you know, role that you're
position. Yep.
And I see over and over again, people disappointing those roles, you know, especially the men, you know, where they're not doing what the oldest brother is supposed to be doing. And that's part of my brother too, is that, you know, and I think that's what happens when you have very specifically defined roles, and it doesn't even matter who the person is. So we're front. And I think that kind of hypervigilance, they would, you know, call it in psychology, is from a reaction to war. You're hypervigilant when you've suffered chaos. You know, you want everything in place. So it's a country that suffered a lot of chaos over time. And it builds this mentality of a lot of shoulds and a lot of, you know, like boxes that people have to be in. And so I think there's something about me growing up in Kentucky, I couldn't possibly fit that box because I didn't even know what it was.
Right.
And my parents were incredibly disappointed that I didn't know what it was that I was supposed to do. And some part of me knew, oh yeah, I'm supposed to be a doctor and I'm supposed to like pay for everything for you guys. Like, right. Is that buy you a house? Is that what I'm supposed to do? You know, like, is that my job? And not say a word, you know,
yeah,
not anything.
You know, there's after I've watched your movie, I was thinking like every kid grows up, a lot of kids grow up and like, oh, I wish my story was made into a movie. Right. But that's not the way this works. The medium of film is much more deliberate and intentional when you have to put a project together. And you learn that when you're going through the process over and over again, that not every good story can be turned into a movie. But how did you know, like, you had enough story there to create a 1-hour movie?
Well, I actually wanted to do a series. You know, I had this idea in my head that I wanted to know what happened to all the Vietnamese people after the war, you know, on both sides. And I also want to know what happened to some of the Americans, you know, like I want to know how war affected people and how it affected people I loved and people I didn't know. So I had this idea that I was going to do like a, you know, kind of a, like a Ken Burns type thing, that it was going to be the series. I didn't know who was going to fund it. I didn't know how much it cost. I didn't know anything, honestly, about filmmaking. I just had this passion for oral history, really, you know, that these people are going to die. We have to record their stories, you know, and I have a passion for history. So I didn't even know what the story was, honestly. So when I went into it, I just thought, I'm just doing a film on the Vietnamese today. You know, that's how I saw it. And the more, you know, I worked with like professional editors, they're like, the real story here is your family, like your immediate family. And that wasn't something that I was exactly comfortable with, because we didn't even film me at all. Like, Ham would not put the camera on me. Like, it was only accidental when he would film me. You know, I remember wanting him to film me, but he just didn't listen to me because he's a director himself, you know, like he had his own thing going on. So we had to like kind of like scrap for like anything with me in it, you know, because I was the connecting person of the project. So like later cinematographers would film me, but, you know, like, but what connected all of these people was me. And that was an odd place to be, because I saw myself as a historian, you know, I didn't see myself as a character in the film too. I didn't think I had a story. And my story doesn't appear on there. Like, you don't know that much about me from that film, except for that I'm very codependent with my family.
How did your family change after the film was made? How has it affected your family?
Well, it completely changed my relationship with my dad. You know, I mean, I didn't know him before. He hadn't told me anything about himself. I didn't even know he had a brother who was still alive in Vietnam, except for one, but he had several. He just never mentioned them. And he didn't mention that he'd fought in the war against his older brother. Like, I was completely clueless. I remember showing up and being like, oh, hi, uncle. What was it like to live with the communists? He's like, what do you mean? And I'm like, so yeah, like you lived with the communists all this time. I am a communist. And I was like, oh shit. And I just said, well, what was it like to fight against your family? And he made some remark where he was just like, my family was, you know, my father was Ho Chi Minh. Like that's what he said. My family was the Communist Party, you know? So I was like, crap, wow, that is. And my aunt told me a story about how in 1975, she was the youngest, you know, of my dad's family and significantly younger than my oldest uncle, Hai, who was, you know, born in 1930. She was born in like 1959 or something, 1960. So that's a big age difference. So she was a little girl and she said a man came in the house and put his arms around their mother and was crying and crying and crying. And he hadn't seen his mother since he was 15 years old. Because he went to join, you know, to fight the French and he got caught. He split the country.
Yeah. So it was a conscious decision for your uncle at 15 to go up north to fight?
Well, it was kind of like, it's such a long story. I mean, yeah. I'll tell you, but he didn't really have a choice because my grandfather wrote anti-French things, pamphlets and things like that. And he was a governor of Hainan province and he wasn't allowed to do that because Vietnam was still a colony of France at the time before 1954, which is something I forget. And then I look at my dad's birth certificate and everything's in French, you know? And it's like, oh, weird. I forgot we were a French colony before, you know, like for 90 years or whatever. And so he wrote, you know, he wanted Vietnamese independence, my dad's father, and he got caught and he was taken by Vietnamese people who worked for the French, you know, who were, they were officially French soldiers.
I think Viet Minh. No.
Yeah. Viet Minh. No, the opposite of Viet Minh.
The opposite of Viet Minh. Yeah. During that time period.
Yeah. So it was like the Foreign Legion, you know.
Yeah. So the people the Viet Minh were fighting
against. Yeah. Yes. Who they fought in Dinh Binh Phu. And so, you know, there were French people there, but there were also Vietnamese working for the French. And I think he was captured by, this I heard from my step-grandmother, but he was captured by these people, these French who worked for the French. And they took him, like, they took him far away and they wanted to kill him, you know, they wanted to execute him. So my grandfather found out and he took his family and went back to the beach city of Hang Thiac where he came from to hide them. But they caught up with him anyway and they took him from my family and they drove him up like far away, like in central Vietnam. And they were too chicken to kill him. Like they didn't want to kill him because he was one of their own. I mean, they were Vietnamese. So they were told to kill him. But they were like, how do we kill him? Like, we don't want to kill him, you know? And he was very charming, apparently. So they put him in a French uniform and threw him in the jungle.
Wow.
So someone else would kill him, like hoping that the Viet Minh would kill him. They kind of put him in a Viet Minh area. But the Viet Minh didn't kill him. And he was with these other revolutionaries, you know, who'd written stuff against the French government. So they ended up like starting like a pharmaceutical company, like in the middle of nowhere and, you know, marrying, you know, other women basically. And my poor grandmother, who was from a very, very wealthy family. I mean, this is like grit, right? This is like, she didn't know what to do with her kids. She, you know, he didn't leave her enough money. She was far away from her family in Thainan. Like she had no, you know, and it was really hard to travel back then. If you think about it, the 40s and 50s in Vietnam, you know, it's not like people had cars. You know, how did you get anywhere?
Yeah.
And so she ended up first like drying fish, you know, to like make a living. And she had to basically give away all her children. So she married off her oldest daughter to the richest guy in town who owned a fish sauce factory. And she sent her oldest boy to fight against the French. And my dad, she sent to live with his grandfather and then his aunt, you know, like, so all the kids got distributed to different places. And she kept the youngest one at the time. And he has a story where he said one night, and she'd made a tent, like a hut, like she, you know, there she was, this rich woman, like dumped somewhere with no home. She like fashioned a hut, and then they had one blanket with them and a machete, I guess. So he said somebody came at night and pulled their blanket off of them. You know, it was like wartime Vietnam. People were poor. There was no fabric to be had. So he said that she crawled out of the tent with a machete in her hand, like in her mouth, and came back with the blanket. And so, you know, she then learned her brother-in-law was like one of the first Western doctors in Vietnam. And Baxi Pho, who was a famous communist, actually, he, you know, housed Ho Chi Minh. And, but she learned from him, like, and Baxi Pho actually pushed my uncle into fighting against the French and was a part of that. You know, they have a museum to Ho Chi Minh now in Phang Thiệt that was his home. And so my grandmother learned to be a midwife, and she learned.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly, but then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
From her brother-in-law, and then she, you know, made a lot of money as a midwife, and then she owned rubber plantations, and then she went, had people look for her husband. So it was like years later, and they found him, and he was married with like a couple of other kids. And, you know, she said, "I want you back." And he said, "But I'm married with like, you know, two kids." And she said, "I'll take him. I'll raise him. I have the money." And his wife, my step grandmother, became a nun after that, a Buddhist nun.
Wow.
So, I mean, it's just crazy the amount of stories that came out of this work that never
Read The Mountain Sings?
No, I haven't.
Yeah, talks about the North in a way. When I first read the book, it was just the hearing these stories from you. You're telling it from a Southern, you know, point of view, a family that is from the South. When I read the book, The Mountain Sings by Nguyen Phan Quy Mai, you're reading it from the North, and it's in perfect English, and you're just like, whoa, it's so surreal to hear it. Being explained from like underneath the tree canopies up in the North, American bombs are coming down.
Yeah.
And anytime I hear the Northern narrative, either from the South or from the North themselves, it's strange because, you know, we've always grown up with the boat story, you know, the refugee story narrative, and I'm at home with that. But when I hear it from you, somebody, especially from the South, talking about, you know, your Northern family and how they sort of got brought into it, it's fascinating because we're all just humans at the end of the day. Look, we're just humans. How did we end up fighting each other? You know, and this shit's going on today too.
And then, you know, a man who's like shooting at his own family coming home after, how many, 1954 to 1975 is
two decades,
21 years and longer for him. Cause it was before 1954 that he joined, you know, so probably 25 years, I think, for him, to come home to your, I think in 1945 was when he joined. So to come home to your mother that you haven't seen in decades, you know, I just can't imagine. And so he was so staunchly communist because he had to explain why he fought against his own family. You know, it's like he had to explain his life in a way, you know. And I think he was a doctor at the end, and, you know, he was helping people. You know, he wasn't shooting after you know, a while. Like he started off like as a soldier, but then he, you know, worked printing presses, and then he became a doctor. And But, you know, he saw that the government didn't particularly treat him that well, you know, and, but he got to say that he was the winner and he was right, you know, and just how people hold on to that sort of explanation of what their choices. I mean, what choice did he have? He couldn't leave and go back home. The country had been divided. You know, it would have been really dangerous.
Yeah.
You know, to have gone through that, you know, the entire, I mean, to take, to go the entire length of Vietnam on foot, it would take a long time. I mean, the coast of Vietnam is longer than the west coast of America.
Yeah.
I think people don't realize, you know. And
it's not just California. It's like all up in Oregon, Washington, like the whole coast. Yeah. And that's, you know, if you spend any time driving on the California coast, that's a long drive.
I mean, in a fast car, that's still like several days, you know, to get all the way up to Seattle.
So your next project is Oh America, right? Mm-hmm. And what was the inspiration for this next project?
I wasn't planning on, you know, I tried to do like a film about the women in my family around, you know, women being raped. And, you know, because there was a lot of unacknowledged sexual assault that happened to women when they escaped by boat. In my mother's case, she was in an arranged marriage. So it was a marital rape in for her first marriage to my half sister's father. And there were, you know, and my rape is being a teenager in Kentucky, you know, and this was something none of us acknowledged. My aunt was a you know, molested on the way via refugee camps, you know, and so no one talked about it. And it was something I really wanted to do a project on, but it was very hard because there's stigma, you know, in both cultures in America and Vietnam around rape victims. And so, especially in Vietnam, you know, because it's sort of like, it's your fault. And I think there is still that kind of belief in America, even though people don't say it. But I wanted to bring it to light. This was before the Me Too movement came along, you know, so I was doing this and like working on this film, like after Oh Saigon, like 2008 or so. And my aunt later became a sex worker. Like she was like a geisha for Japanese businessmen. And I that connection between, you know, her molestation, you know, in the camps and her becoming a sex worker, you know, essentially, you know, even though she kind of, it's also like a party planner in a way, but there is that aspect of her work. And I wanted to kind of show like the influence of that kind of trauma on people and particularly like on Vietnamese women. But I felt like I was almost violating them by pushing them to do it when they were.
How long into the project did you realize that?
Well, I was filming it and, you know, I told them that I would animate it and then I would try and, you know, hide their identity in some way. But, you know, people already knew them from the other film. So it would have been really hard to do.
Yeah.
And I didn't feel like there was a way that I could protect them. And they were doing it because they loved me, not because they wanted to. And they were very uncomfortable. And I can't do this to them, you know? And so I was like, it's going to end up being a book or something. And I tried to do a film about, you know, the hi-fi video store and the attack on it when they had a picture of Ho Chi Minh. And then I went to Vietnam to kind of film the sort of worship of Ho Chi Minh there because my uncle in his last days, he didn't tell me he was dying, but I wanted to see him again. And I wanted an excuse to film him again. So I came and filmed him for that movie and it didn't really pan out, but there's parts of that movie that I could use for this one. And then so I was kind of trying to find my next project. And then my brother marched on the Capitol on January 6th of 2021.
But did you know that he had tendencies to kind of like hang out in that part of the political spectrum?
He was becoming that way. I mean, he liked George Bush, like, you know, which it's like, you know, was unlike the rest of my family, actually, like, or at least my immediate family. My dad was a Democrat and his sisters are Republicans. But my dad, you know, really hated Reagan. He thought that he hated immigrants and poor people. And he was very much against that. And he was very much for my dad is very pro-democracy, pro-freedom. that he thought that the Republican Party was all for the wealthy, which I agree with him, but you know,
he's not wrong.
I think there's all kinds of different Republicans too. You know, there's different ones for who have different.
Yeah.
So, but certain ones for sure have that kind of mentality. And so, you know, and then certain Democrats I'm sure sell out as well. And, but, you know, when my brother, he kind of became apolitical. He actually had voted for Obama at one point, but he was sort of like not really into politics. He was really into sports and that was his thing. And, you know, he was kind of like a playboy and worked in real estate. And then he lost everything in 2008 when the markets fell. He lost his home that he was trying to flip, you know, lost his real estate, lost his investments. I think he stopped being able to play sports as much, you know, because he's getting older and he's getting injured. And he basically dealt with the entire Vietnam War by playing sports. I mean, as a child, he just threw himself into soccer, you know, and then when he moved to America, he threw himself into sports and into the ROTC. So he was really into order and, you know, something clear, like I kick a ball there, you know, like that made sense to him. And I think it gave him a lot of, you know, and this winning and losing all the time, you know, the adrenaline you get from that. Like you think of a war survivor and that you have the chance to win through a sport, you know, somebody whose side lost. And I think of how important that must have been for him. Like, even though I don't think he can articulate that, but, you know, he really enjoyed playing sports and then he got injured and he was not able, he could have been a professional player had he like been under different circumstances, I think. And he did, you know, he played, he was a starter for his university team in soccer. He played all-state football in high school on the all-state team. Like he was, you know,
very athletic.
Yeah. Captain of the soccer team, captain of the tennis team, battalion commander of his ROTC, you know, so that's something that really, you know, spoke to him, that kind of, he was emulating my dad, like being a leader.
Wow.
And, you know, my dad was a major in the Air Force. And so he was trying to, you know, he was doing that role, but then he kind of couldn't hold it up anymore. And I think, you know, you don't want to blame yourself for those sort of decisions. Like I suggested, don't buy a house right now. It's markets are going to fall, but you know, I'm his little sister, so he's not going to listen to me. And then it happened and he lost everything. And he kind of borrowed a lot of money from the family and kind of went to a shameful place. So what do you do at that point? How do you win yourself back? And so this is this thing I was talking about when people lose, like the banks were bailed out, you know, but what about people like my brother? They weren't bailed out, you know? They weren't, you know, given their homes back, you know, they weren't forgiven loans or whatever. And so that was something that really struck me, is like this whole thing of like when the communists won the war, they didn't address the people who lost and they wanted them to be citizens by brainwashing them and imprisoning them and making them do hard labor. That was going to get you what you wanted. I saw the distinct resentment of people in the South when I interviewed them, you know, about the Ho Chi Minh film. And then I saw the distinct worship of him when I was in the North. And I was just like, these are people in the same country, but how is this the case? And then, you know, my brother, he was going through a lot of Trump rallies. And, you know, I just kind of was like, okay. And then he said, he was going to this Trump rally in DC to about stopping the steal, as he called it. And, you know, so I was like, okay. And then that day we were texting him and watched the violence happen. And we were texting him like, oh my God, are you okay? And, you know, like he was kind of in denial at first and, you know, said like fake news. Cause he wasn't in the very front, you know, when they started busting, he was further back. But there were, if you look at the footage of the photographs, there's always a little Vietnamese flag, like South Vietnamese flag and a lot of the photo. And along with Confederate flags, along with the don't tread on me flags, a lot of old flags of defunct countries that lost wars, you know, like, right? Like the Confederate States, they lost the war. The South Vietnamese, they lost the war. And there they were saying, don't steal from us. We want it back. We want victory, you know, and we're going to take it. And to me, that was just so like, I just couldn't wrap my head around what happened, you know, the violence, because I suddenly felt so American, like, this is my capital, you know, like, stay off my capital. Don't, you know, don't get into my political process. Don't, you know, and so I took it kind of personally, and I was just reeling. And I remember writing a Facebook post and saying, like, I cannot believe my brother was at the Capitol. And people just responded, like, in droves, in a way that they don't normally post to mine, you know? And, you know, my filmmaker friends were like, you have to make a movie about this. And I was like, wow. No, I can't. And then, you know, Chris Seacat, who was a part of the original beginning of O Saigon, he said, call it O America. And then people are like, this is about the second generation of your family, the political split. It's like they gave me everything in a Facebook post. And I was like, you're right. You're right. Like, you know, people have been saying it to me all along. Like Duc Nguyen was saying, you should make a movie about your brother. Like, but finally I was like, I felt like I had a duty to do it. And I didn't know what I was going to get out of it, you know, because the movie's not finished. I did just get a National Endowment for the Humanities grant. I just found out yesterday.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah, it's really amazing. And it's amazing to feel like no one wants to pay me to do this, you know? Instead of me having to scrounge and, you know, make it happen and, you know, like do it guerrilla style. It's like, wow, I could actually get paid for this.
Yeah.
So it was just this thing of like, I didn't know, like O Saigon, I didn't know what I was going to get into. I didn't know what I was going to hear. I didn't know what I was going to be moved by. But in this process, I'm really seeing, I guess, humanity, you know, like I'm seeing, you know, and that's the thing when you put yourself in the place of a documentary filmmaker or a journalist or something, you, even whatever your personal beliefs are, you have to choose the truth of the matter,
right?
You know, to broadcast. Like, so I don't care what my personal beliefs are politically. What I care about is, why did this happen? How did this happen? And why are the Vietnamese Americans there? Like, you know, and why was my brother there? And, you know, what happened in his life that led him to this moment?
Right.
And let me look at the fracturing of all these other Vietnamese and the Vietnamese Americans families and Americans, you know. And I interviewed a number of these men who, my mom wanted me to find the men who rescued us out of Vietnam, the Marines, the US Marines. So I went on a search and found this organization, you know, who had been in the fall of Saigon. And some of them had gotten in touch with me on Facebook after seeing O Saigon. And I finally interviewed them last year, you know, on Zoom during the pandemic of, no, I think it was for the 45th, what anniversary was it of the war? 45th, I don't remember which anniversary.
45th, yeah.
Yeah.
Like last year?
Yeah, the 45th anniversary. And so 2020. So I found them and interviewed them. And, you know, a number of them have very different political beliefs from me. And they were Facebook friends of mine, so I knew that they did. And I felt like a little trepidation about interviewing them and not knowing how it was going to go, you know? And what I found was that they had very similar PTSD to me. Like, we hate the month of April and we hate helicopters and we have survivor guilt of the people who didn't make it and the people left behind. And we felt like this huge sense of responsibility that wasn't our fault. We weren't the only, you know, it's not my fault that I was a three-year-old taken out by my family.
Yeah.
And that they didn't manage to get my sister out. You know, it's, but I felt like it was, and they felt like it, you know, it's like, yeah, they knew that it wasn't their fault that two of their own had died in the last moments of the war and that they got to make it out. And one was 18 years old. He just graduated from high school, you know, but they still feel the guilt after all of these years. And I was looking at these men who are like, you know, now in their 60s and they're not that much older than me. You know, they were only 19, 20, 22 at the time. And, you know, just like you could see it on their faces, you know, that when they talk about it, the grief that's still there, you know, and you see that with all survivors. And like, even you weren't even there,
still feel it.
Don't carry the grief, yeah. right, of loss. And I think that's the thing that people don't see about war. It's like, it's not just an action that happens over there, you know, somewhere else. It's something that is just carried on in generations, you know, like you, it's like, you can't undo loss. You can't undo violence. You know, the violence lives with you. I think Vietnamese families are known to be quite violent, and they've lived with so much war. You know, they believe in corporal punishment more than other countries in studies. And you see how that affects, you know, the intensity of that upbringing and how it affects all of us. And I guess for me, it's kind of like, what choice am I going to make knowing where I came from and knowing right. my tendencies? It's like, I have a violent temper that is there. You know, there's sometimes this rage. And I know that it's not like who I am, but it came from mm-hmm. the rage that my family felt, the rage that my parents felt that they didn't know what to do with. And they took it out on me. And I just said to myself, I'm not going to do that. I'm never going to do that. And I think that's, you know, unfortunately why I didn't have children. Because I was so afraid.
Yeah.
Of that rage coming out at a child. Like, that's something I never wanted to do. And so I have great relationships with my like nephew and nieces and godchildren. But I think I was so terrified of continuing violence. I chose to stop, you know, like the buck stops here. Like, I'm not doing that. I'm
yeah, only- not repeating that.
Yeah. And I think that's what I do in my work now, is that I try and see the humanity, you know, and it was so hard for me to see the humanity in my brother. I was so angry with him, you know, and he also has very different beliefs than me about, you know, the pandemic, which happens a lot. He, you know, he really got into QAnon, and he's also a member of a cult. And, you know, that, so I felt like he was endangering my mother because he lives with her, and, you know, it was really difficult. And he was threatening me, saying, don't you get our mother vaccinated, you know, I'll never speak to you again, and you won't get to see my daughter. And, you know, and it's this sort of intense reaction all around. And I've had to learn to really remind myself what love is. And that my brother, even though he was so scary to me when he was in the state and spewing this stuff, like, he asked me if I drank the blood of children for adrenochrome or adrenochrome or whatever you call it, that, you know, this is one of these QAnon ideas that, you know, that the liberals drink the blood of children. And I was kind of like, what? And, you know, it's kind of like, you're so far gone from anything yeah. that I remember. But then I remember, like, this is the same person who taught you how to blow bubbles from yeah. chewing gum. This is the same person who was your tooth fairy, you know, and brought you American culture that way, and walked you to see Star Wars, you know, in the summertime, who was practically your mother, taught you how to shoot hoops. And I had to remember, like, he's the same person, you know, he's just going through something and he's doing it in his own way. And he's making choices that you wouldn't make, or he's having beliefs that you wouldn't have, but he's still your brother.
Yeah.
And you still love him. And if he were killed in a car accident, you would be really bummed out, you know? And I saw that with my father. Like, my father, you know, had moments of violence at me, and my mom a lot. But it was one time my dad nearly killed me, like, when he lost his temper. And when he was dying, that same hand that punched me was reaching out for me, shaking, you know? And I saw him there so helpless and sick in the hospital on his dying, you know, moments. He was about, to, you know, and it was really wild because I was about to leave the hospital, and there was, like, in the next room that somebody was dying, and there were Buddhist chants and gongs going off, and it was kind of ominous, you know. And my dad was there, and he had been kind of sleeping on and off, which I didn't realize was basically, he was going into a coma, you know, and we didn't know what was happening, but they were sedating him a lot. And he woke up suddenly, and my sister and I were there, my younger sister and I, and we're saying goodbye to him, like, Dad, we're going to go. And I had this sudden thought of like, Dad, wow, you used to take me to the mall every Friday when I was, before I could drive, and you went to work that day, like 45 minutes each way. And the mall was also 45 minutes away. And he went two trips, one to drop me off and one to pick me up. So he did like three round trips or four round trips in a day to drive his teen daughter to go have fun with her friends. And I just remembered that out of nowhere. And I said, Dad, do you remember that? And he couldn't talk because he had a tracheotomy and he had, you know, his throat was, you know, had a big hole in it. And he said, he just nodded. I said, you remember that? And I said, you were a good dad. And he started to cry. Of course, my sister Kat and I both started crying too. And, you know, and I was like, Dad, don't cry. This is not the last time we're going to see you, you know, we'll see you again. So we hugged him goodbye, and then he fell into a coma, and that was the last time he was ever awake. My father, what made him sick in the first place was his brother died. He hadn't seen his brother, you know, since he was 7 years old, and then he saw him in Oh Saigon for the first time, you know, in 59 years. And it really healed something for him, because it was like this separation from his family that I think really broke him, you know, as a person, made him a very quiet, kind of withdrawn person, you know, which was a perfect military personality. But his separation from his brother was one of the most painful things of his young life, and from his other siblings. And then he had two siblings die, you know, in the separation. His older sister died in childbirth. His younger brother died of illness when they were separated and they were given away, you know, temporarily by my grandmother. And so this made him the way he was. And I think because he couldn't talk about how much pain he was in with his family, because he was trying to protect us, it all went inward, you know? And so when I took him back to Vietnam, it was like something had opened up in him. You see the physical change in him, you know, you see him walking differently. He's laughing, you know, he like seems like a completely different person from him in Kentucky to him in Vietnam. And I think he really cherished that. So he got to see his older brother twice before his brother died of stomach cancer. And my Uncle Hyde did not tell us he was dying. So we didn't know, you know, I think I felt something, but, you know, and then after that, my dad got really depressed and got ill and never recovered. And so that was something that I sort of saw in this film for me about my own brother. Like, I have a longer relationship with my brother than my dad did with his brother. So I kind of wondered what it would be like. Like, what if he had been killed on January 6th or something, you know? Like, and I was spending all this time hating on him because he thought differently for me. How would I feel? You know? And so I see my dad's story as a parable to this situation, where it's about brothers who chose different sides and fought against each other and then came back together and realized that they loved each other. And I was thinking, like, am I going to have to be that old to discover the meaning of the story? Or can I adopt this now, even though I feel, you know, like so annoyed with my older brother, you know? And I had to remind myself that, like, how would you feel if he died? And, you know, and then where does that put everything? All of your political differences, all of the things that you are mad about that he said to you, like, is it worth it? You know? And I wanted to learn from my dad's death and his sacrifice and his, you know, I didn't want, like, oh, then their family was separated, the end, you know, like that. I didn't want that to be the end of our family story. Or yeah, the Vietnamese.
If you think about this, that you project this all around the country, within the Vietnamese community first, you know, the young and the old, Trump and, you know, Biden, or you divide it into political lines, and you get together for Thanksgiving, and there's fighting at the table and disagreement. What is that really getting any of us anymore? You know, at this point, I too am in the same boat with, there's cousins that I don't talk to anymore. And they know, you know, we all know which side we all, you know, but when we take it back to when we were like 7 years old and we went to the beach together, you know, those are precious and beautiful moments in our family's history, as well as our childhood history. And, you know, our siblings,
they're a part of you.
Part of you. Yeah. And what, you know, I have an uncle now who's very staunch Trump supporter. And I love him dearly. We were very close. At some point, you just have to say enough. No more fighting, no more debating. This is senseless. So we get together and we talk about other things that we, you know, make a conscious decision to, like, we're not politicians. What are we going to do? And he's not controlling like the oil reserves, and I'm not controlling arms, the nuclear arms. Like, we're nobody. Why are we like trying to be like we're somebody and trying to control some narrative that's not in our control? So now it's, you know,
why are we reacting that way? That's yes. Really the question. Because it's kind of like why are so many people in our country yes. reacting that way? You know, my next door neighbor in Kentucky, we've always had political differences and we never cared. You know, we always would kind of make fun of each other about it. And then for the first time ever, I found myself chewing him out on Facebook, you know, for saying, you know, like he became like anti-immigrant. And he had like an American map that said, fuck off, we're full. And I was like, do you realize that I'm an immigrant, that I'm a refugee and we're close friends? And, you know, and he like was so horrified that he actually kind of closed down his account. But I told him, can you just watch The Social Dilemma? I'll watch it too. I haven't seen it. So the both of us watched it that night and talked the next day. And wow. He was just like, in his Kentucky accent, like, man, I had no idea how much they were manipulating me for money. You know, like and I was like, me too. And that's, you know, cause it's like an algorithm is going to make me hate you because I keep seeing more and more things that are outrage me or more and more things that are, you know,
triggering.
Yeah. Triggering towards me. And I keep getting more of that information if I look at it. And it's going to keep coming at me. And you're doing the same thing. We're all feeding ourselves so Facebook can make money, you know, so we can keep clicking.
And but I think that society is like getting fatigue. We're getting fatigued. We're getting hate fatigued.
Yeah.
Because I feel like we're correcting. We're now things are a little bit more loose. And I don't feel like that tension with my uncles or, you know, certain people that I know that are in the different camp. And it's a good thing. And then, you know, I mean, how could you sustain that much hate for the next, you know, decade or two? You know,
I really impossible. Think it was the pandemic, you know, because I mean, for one thing, you know, there was a lot of stuff that happened with Trump and the election that was disunifying. But also on top of that, you had some, you know, when you ever have a shocking moment, like the pandemic happening, who knew what was happening? The people who were experts in it didn't know what was happening, you know, and it took them a long time to, you know, feel like they had an understanding of the coronavirus that we were going through and, you know, COVID-19 and, you know, and so no one knew and everyone was scared. So what do you do when you're scared? You hold on to something, right? To kind of keep you afloat. And for some people, it's data. They hold on to certain data, right? And for me, like I would call it bad data. You know, but I don't actually know, you know, I don't actually know if I'm right.
Right.
You know, like you said, who am I? Like, I'm just a person. Like I'm, you know, even experts all have different opinions. So it's like these, you know, we're all holding on to like, how do I survive this? So everyone's trying to survive and they latch onto certain ideas. And for me, it's like, let me do it perfectly. Let me do it the way the experts say. You know, let me, you know, wear my mask and get my vaccine and do these things the way I believe is right, but I'm no expert. And then my brother has that, like I'm getting from what I think are experts that masks will kill you and cause you, you know, to And I'm like, but that doesn't make sense with the doctors and nurses wearing masks all the time, you know, but it doesn't matter what you think makes sense or doesn't. You're like, when people need something, they need it. And for me, it's kind of like my brother needed to think that it was easier for him to think that somebody was actively trying to harm him instead of thinking we have no clue what's going on, you know? So, and now I see it as like, he's just coping. He's coping and trying to fly. And so
could be dealing with that PTSD too. I mean, that's like a direct link of, you know, of the way we're processing information. You know, it's a pattern or traumatic pattern. I don't know, that's my guess. But how also, far?
You know, also interestingly, like Viet Thanh Wing and I are nearly the same age. We're like 1 year apart. And I thought it was interesting that we came to America as very small children, and we both had a very similar reaction to what happened to us. We both are into oral history, you know, like we both became kind of historians in our own ways and like documenters in our own ways. And then my brother, you know, was close to seven, you know, like my friend Shannon, her sister was like six or seven when their dad died suddenly. And also went the same direction as my brother. So I kind of wonder if like PTSD happens, like you're a certain age when something happens, you process it in a certain way and you have another reaction, you know, when something else comes up that makes you react in this way. So I have all these theories, you know, about it. I mean, who knows, you have to study it, but I do believe that trauma that people had previously has really influenced how they've reacted in the pandemic.
How far along are you with O America?
I'm still shooting. Still I'm working on a trailer. I'm raising money for it. And, you know, I would say like I'm half have shot what I need to, you know, around it.
And can I ask you, when you say that you're around half, right? You don't know. You're living in real time right now. You don't know how this is going to end, right? Or do you have an idea?
I do have an idea because of, you know, what we were talking about, like with, you know, all the stuff I've filmed all along has led me to this point, because it isn't just about my brother, but it's about, you know, generations of my family. Where did we, you know, where did we get to division? How does division become a choice, you know? Like there, it exists in my family, in my dad's generation, it existed in my grandfather's generation, that people were divided politically. And I just thought, well, that'll never happen to us. And here I am.
Here you go.
You know, I was like, how does that happen? I remember even before the pandemic and before all the protests saying like, gosh, the 60s looked like they were pretty tough. Like we haven't had that kind of thing, you know, and like, dun, 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 you know, whoops. And I remember telling you literally right before the pandemic, saying to one of my older friends, like, what was that like living through such terrible times? You know, like, And I was like, okay, now I know. Thanks. I shouldn't have asked. Like, we can just walk that back and take away the last few years. But, you know, what has been really interesting about it too is like all of us in the whole world have suffered through this pandemic. You got to wonder, like, what did it do to Putin? How did he respond to this? So it's like all of
I don't think it touched him.
Coming out of it, you know?
I don't think it touched him. I don't. I think at that level where he's, you know, there's like these shots of
Joe Johnson. Boris Johnson got sick, you know, Trump got sick. Like they're world leaders getting COVID, you know. I think Macron got sick too. And so there was a possibility that he could get sick and die. I think everyone had that, you know. Yeah. You're watching people, millions of people around the world dying and trying to make sense of it.
But you see Putin in these large boardrooms and the tables. And so there's like 10 chairs and there's nobody surrounding him.
Yeah.
I can imagine him living through the pandemic that way too.
Right, right. Exactly. So maybe he got a little screwed up in the pandemic, you know, with isolation, right? Maybe this is part of it. So it's like, maybe all of us, you know,
affected.
Yes. Yeah. And that we can't, he's still human, you know, even though he's doing things that are upsetting so many people in the world, he's still a human being and he's still reacting to something.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm trying to get to, this thing of like, even though people have reactions that we don't like, is it going to help if I hate them? Is it going to help that I judge them and deem them as worthless or evil or whatever, and they deem me that way? What's that going to help?
You know? Why do I have a feeling that's like the thesis of America?
You might be right.
What you just said there is sort of, I think, what we've been really talking about in the last, hour and a half or so. It's that. It's like, what is this? We're just all human, and we're tripping up, and we're falling down, and we're just getting right back up. And sometimes we get caught in a bad streak.
And this is it. My dad was a staunch anti-communist, you know, pro-capitalist. My uncle was a staunch anti-capitalist, pro-communist. And there they were fighting against each other in a war. Brothers, like, yeah, they felt it. They felt it, you know, they missed each other. They couldn't write letters for years and even connect at all because of the way, you know, they weren't communicating, the two sides. So what happens when the two sides don't communicate? You know, it's like those people don't stop existing, you know, just because you don't like what they have to say or what they believe. And then eventually the war was over. So what did they accomplish? These two men who spent, you know, 20 years fighting on different sides. What did it accomplish? They were still brothers in the end, you know? And I feel like that could be something that we look at here is like, yes, like my movie is called Oh America, Divided Country. And So it's like, here we are again, here I am again in another divided country. And I didn't think I would be in this position again. And it's like hopefully the pandemic will end. Hopefully these divisions will end. And what will have come of all of this? You know, when you look back at your life, do you make the choices? Like, I'm so glad I didn't speak to my brother for 30 years, you know? Like, no one says that.
No.
When they're dying, no one says that. I am so glad I doubled down, you know, like
nobody says that.
Yeah. It's the only things you regret is not loving more, not being a bigger person. So if you know what you're going to regret when you're dying, why don't you just start today? Right. I want to be the bigger person, even though I don't always feel it. When I want to tell my brother off, I just say like, what is this going to accomplish?
Yeah.
And the truth is like, there are methods that you can actually have a civil conversation with someone. Like you don't have to just not talk about it. Yes. That's one way you can do it, but you can also kind of talk about what you love about your beliefs.
Right.
And why I did that with my cousin, V. Like she is a Trump supporter, and I'm not even a Biden supporter. I go even further, you know? And I said to her like, well, the reason I don't like Trump is because he said a lot of racist things, and that those things really hurt me and hurt other people, I think. So I'm really surprised that you like someone who I consider racist. And she was like, oh, how interesting. And she was, you know, saying like, I like Trump because he's anti-communist. And he, you know, he fights against the Chinese and this, you know, so we got to like actually have a conversation about why we like what we liked. And that is actually way more effective than saying you're an idiot, you're stupid, you're worthless, you know, like you're not going to accomplish. No one's going to listen to you if you say you're wrong, you're wrong, you're wrong. So I'm willing to say like, I don't know everything. No. I could be wrong. Let me hear why this means something to you. And I think it's that curiosity and that humanity, to see the humanity in anyone else, including Putin, you know, for me, that's the answer is like, how can we appeal to each other's humanity?
Well, Dawn, I look forward to watching America when you finish, because I think that it's a very timely film to put out the conversation of healing, and really to ask ourselves, why continue the strong debates where it leads to nothing?
Yeah, because I think that's one thing that Marianne Williamson said that affected people in the debates was like, where's the love in the politics?
Yeah,
you know,
we got to bring that back.
Like every being on this planet, every animal loves, you know, that's how we're all here. We're all products of love. and we all have it in us. So, you know, and people can brush it aside and be like, pshaw, but this is the one thing that holds us together, is that we all love our families. Yeah. And we all love our children. We all love, you know, our neighbors, or try to, you know, and it's just like, and what would it be if we didn't, like, if we just had, we're at war at everybody that we came into contact with, the world would be a terrible place. In fact, the world would probably blow up. And I hope that doesn't happen right now. Yeah. I hope there's a way that the world doesn't blow up. And I hope that we don't go into World War III, because all of us survivors know, war survivors know, that you never really recover, you know? And I am so grateful that I somehow have found that bit of love in me, despite all of the trauma and rage that I grew up with, and the violence that I grew up with, that was a result of war, that, you know, the poverty, all the things that war causes, separation, that I've somehow, like, through this work of connecting with people, asking them questions, saying, what was it like? That's what brought me to this place. And I hope that everybody else can do that with each other. Like, what's it like for you? You know, just that curiosity alone, that little bit of love, that little bit of light, you know, that you can just muster to connect with people, especially in times where we're so disconnected and so been isolated from each other. You know, if you can just find that one little moment of connection, that could just mean, and that's how, what that sparks off. You know, like, if you're in a, if someone's rude to you, you think of it, how that affects your day.
Right.
And when someone's nice to you, how that affects your day. If we all did that, things would change.
Dawn, thank you so much for today. I had a very eye-opening, as usual, like, these kinds of topics really open up my heart, and, you know, and makes me understand our culture a lot deeper. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay. Talk to you soon. Great. Okay. Bye. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. The Vietnamese is produced by Brittany Tran. Special thanks to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Crystal Trin. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast. You can also find us on YouTube, where you can subscribe, like, and comment. Please rate and give us a review wherever you find our podcasts. Thanks again for listening.